Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome and thank you very much for coming. Appreciate your attendance this evening. Last week we spoke about the five unhealthy habits of Orthodox Jews, and we had about five times as many people here, so I guess everybody was scared away. Or maybe they didn't want to hear tonight that they're going to have to unvaccinate themselves. But thank you very much for coming. This is a fascinating topic, one that actually excited me much more than I expected it to. Admittedly, when I prepared the topics that I was going to do for this series, I shared it with several physicians in the shul just to get their thoughts, and someone whose opinion matters a lot to me suggested that I talk about this. So I said, okay, why not? I know that's a topic of interest. I never considered it to be a very practical question for myself. It was never much of a question whether I would, be vaccinated or my children, and it's still not a question. But it's a fascinating topic, and I'm actually excited by how much this has really fascinated me. As many of you probably know, it is a hot topic. Even if it's not necessarily of practical interest to anyone here, this is something that is on the minds of many people in the greater population and in the Orthodox community as well. So the title is To Vaccinate or Not to Vaccinate, a Halachic Perspective. We're going to begin this evening talking about some of the background. Again, several new faces tonight. So I've mentioned this disclaimer at every lecture so far that I'm obviously not a physician. So even though I'm going to refer to some medical facts that are technically not halachic nature, I hope that what I'm saying is factual, and if anybody would like to interject at any point and correct or explain anything better, feel free to interrupt. So the question is, which of the following diseases has been completely eradicated from the planet? Sort of a quiz question we'll start off this evening. So you see over here, several diseases, all of which we've heard of. And naturally we know that, some of these used to be much more frightening than they are today. But does anybody know which of these diseases is considered to be essentially eradicated? Yes?
Not completely.
Not completely. But which one has been declared gone, even if...
Diphtheria.
Diphtheria. Polio. Okay, who thinks diphtheria? Polio. Okay, wow. So let's see. So we've heard several answers. The answer is smallpox. Diphtheria, as you can see, over the last 5 years, there have been 25,000 reported cases. Polio still 2,000. Whooping cough 80 million. Measles, 785,000. Rubella, 2.5 million. But smallpox, again, we never know, but as far as we can tell, has been eradicated. This information comes from the CDC website. Now, why is this? What is it? And what was it that's happened over the past 100 years, really less, that has essentially brought the numbers of these dreadful diseases down in such significant numbers, even though, as we see, some of them continue to plague the planet at large? And the answer, of course, is vaccines, or so it would seem. It would seem that with the introduction of vaccines into, major world populations, these diseases have either been completely eliminated or have been controlled to the point where they no longer threaten our survival, and they no longer threaten our community from either, death or from very, very serious ramifications as a result of developing these illnesses. So if that's so, if that's really the case, so then why are we even having this discussion this evening? Because it would seem that there's really nothing to discuss. That from a scientific perspective, vaccination is something which is healthy, something which is smart for one who's looking to safeguard his health. And we've just spent 2 weeks, a total of 2 hours, establishing the very simple fact that without a doubt, from a Torah perspective, from a halachic perspective, we are required to, number one, avoid behaviors or substances or any exposure to something which could be harmful to our health, our well-being, and certainly our survival. And we are even required to proactively engage in activities and behaviors which are healthy and which will sustain us and keep us around as long as God gives us. So why are we having this discussion? So, of course, there was a famous study that many of you have heard of, and although you may not know about as much as you'll hopefully know in the next few minutes, there was a study that was published in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal, in February of 1998. And this particular study is probably, I don't know enough to say this, so I can't say that it's necessarily the most significant of its kind, but it would seem to me, I'm not aware of anything else in which a study was conducted which had such repercussions, not only in the medical world, but has really made its way into each and every one of our minds, you know, whether we know it or not, and that is that this study was the one to first call attention to the fact that there may be an association between vaccination and autism. The findings, which are summarized over here in this early report, is that behavioral symptoms were associated by the parents with measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination in 8 of the 12 children, with measles infection in one child and a tetanus media in another. And you see over here that there are several conditions that are cited, but one of them, behavioral disorders, included autism, in 9 of them, disintegrative psychosis, and possible post-viral or vaccinal encephalitis. And because of this particular study, naturally, people all over the world started to panic and started to wonder whether or not, in our haste to, you know, solve one problem and one disease, which may have been, you know, relatively, you know, under control, we have now created a much bigger problem. So in 1998, 60 Minutes picked up on this, and of course, that really brought it to the prime time. And all of a sudden, everybody starts talking about it. This article, which is just referenced over in Italian court, rules that MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, causes autism. And people start noticing the rise in autism. And there's no explanation for it. In 1980, 1 in 10,000. And in 2013, 1 in 50. The greatest crime ever committed against the American public, as those who would like to blame vaccinations for the rise in autism will claim. And all of a sudden, everybody's panicked, and nobody knows what to do, and feels that they have to protect their children if they can, in fact, enforce legislation to pull back these vaccines, which are very harmful and causing, you know, a very, dreadful disorder of autism, which, again, clearly, as these numbers would seem to indicate, as far as we can tell, at least the way we measure them, is on the rise. Not much thereafter, just really within, within several months, less than a year, this article, which we referenced early, was retracted. The Lancet retracted it. Within a matter of months, you see, I think there are 12 or 13 different people, co-authors, along with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who was the name behind this, they dropped off one by one. They started to pull out. It wasn't clear why initially, but suddenly, you know, this study and its conclusions were, you know, subject to tremendous, tremendous scrutiny. And all of a sudden, as I showed you earlier, you know, all the reports in the news about how terrible this was, and now all of a sudden, you know, everybody's speaking about a U-turn, and all of a sudden revealed that there's a whole scandal over here, and nobody's quite sure what really happened, but apparently there was some real, you know, perhaps fraudulent, you know, very unethical behaviors in the preparation of this study. If you fast forward about 10 years later, in May 2010, the General Medical Council of Great Britain found that the lead author of this study, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, had acted dishonestly and irresponsibly, and 1 month later his medical license was revoked. So this individual, who was responsible for, you know, promoting this message, which ultimately created much fear and panic in the entire world community, you know, the study was retracted initially after much scrutiny, and a decade later, you know, he has lost his license and accused of acting dishonestly and irresponsibly. I believe it's noteworthy, I'm just listening over here separately, that the now discredited study that we've referred to had focused on the link between thimerosal, which is a mercury-based ingredient, and autism. It wasn't the vaccine, the particular, particulars of the vaccine per se, but it was a special ingredient that was placed in the vaccine. And as of 2001, that ingredient was removed from all vaccines other than some of the influenza vaccines anyhow. So it's important to note that the very study, which has been, you know, essentially disproven, was calling for a link between autism and this particular ingredient, which is no longer used anyhow. So I think that even if one, you know, wanted to be choshesh for the fact that maybe there is some major, you know, government conspiracy over here, and truthfully, Andrew Wakefield is the best thing that ever happened to us, because he was the one who, was the honest whistleblower, and the, this is as a conspiracy theorist would have you believe, and the drug companies have paid off the government to keep the information from us. this, you know, this potentially threatening ingredient has been removed anyhow. Yes?
As someone who has had all those diseases, except for polio, as someone who eventually worked as a nurse with all those sick children, and how many children died of hysteria, whooping cough, etc., there is no way I would deny that.
No way that you deny what?
I mean, I would 100%. You and all the children.
Okay, good. Good, so we're good so far. Because I wouldn't argue with you. I would just tell you to take over. So good. So we're still going to be vaccinating our kids. At least, you know, stick around to 9:30. Let's see what happens. This is a very nice, you know, illustration. It's actually three pages, you know, but I couldn't fit it all in one thing. But just sort of summarizes in illustrative form, you know, this whole scandal. I don't want to read through the whole thing again because I don't spend too much time talking about it. But, you know, it's really quite fascinating. It just shows how, again, there were problems with the studies to begin with. It was not based on statistics. There were no control group. It relied on people's memories. I mean, very, very conclusions that weren't statistically valid. No link was found in subsequent studies, starting in 1999 and 2002 and 2001. And by 2012, if you take all of the studies and put them together, 14 million and over 14 and a half million children with 27 cohort studies, 17 case control studies and self, all came to the fact that there was no link to autism that was found in any of these cases. In 2004 already, when Lancet released a statement refuting the original findings, the original was retracted, so they had conducted invasive investigations on the other children without obtaining the necessary ethical clearances. They picked and chose that and suited their case. They falsified facts. Very, very, very serious charges against Dr. Wakefield. It's actually incredible that he managed to hold on to his license for another 6 years after that conclusion, but okay. Nevertheless, despite all this, vaccine vilification survives. What we find is that today, over one quarter of U.S. parents believe some vaccines cause autism in healthy children. I don't want to put my wife on the spot, but I asked her last night about 12:45 in the morning, and it's not fair because that's not the time to ask somebody a question. But I said to her, autism and vaccines. You ever hear that? Yeah. So what do you think? There's a connection? So she said what I would have said, and that is maybe, you know. So the answer is the fact that most of us walk around thinking it may be something too, it shows that the vaccine vilification, which was caused by this study, which created an incredible global panic, continues to this very day. That one quarter of U.S. parents believe, doesn't mean that they choose to withhold vaccinations, but believe that there may be some connection. And close to 2% of parents opt out of vaccines for religious or philosophical reasons. And what we're starting to see, and this already I think you can argue with, you know, as far as the cause and effects over here, but it would seem that in certain communities in which there is less vaccination and people are more, withhold vaccinations from their children, so there seems to be an increase of outbreaks of either the mumps, the measles, and other and certain diseases which would seem were almost eradicated, 10 years ago, are now suddenly on the rise again. And some want to suggest that it's because of the vaccine refusals. That's already, a new theory, which needs to be tested, but certainly plausible. And on the bottom over here, there are common vaccine myths. Vaccines are ridden with toxic chemicals that can harm children. The decision to not vaccinate my child only affects my child. Receiving too many vaccines at once can override a baby's immune system. Drug companies just do it to make profits. So these are the common myths that you'll hear people and maybe perhaps voices inside of our own heads that wonder from time to time what's really going on over here. Yeah?
But certain vaccines are mandatory.
Well, I'm not sure if certain vaccines are mandatory. Schools in particular would like to have us believe that it's mandatory. One of the things that I've learned in my research over here is that at least in New Jersey and New York as well, you can opt out of most vaccines. Whether there are any exceptions, I'm not sure. But the most common vaccines, the ones that we are familiar with and the ones we speak about and the ones that when you go to the doctor's office, they don't ask you want it or not, you can actually opt out. So I believe that as we segue into the second segment of our discussion tonight, we should realize that this topic is of particular relevance to the Orthodox Jewish community at large. Again, it may not necessarily affect anybody here, but this is of relevance to each and every one of us for two reasons. First of all, here this refers to a New York Times article in October 2011. And there was a measles spike in Brooklyn. There have been several of them in the past 5 or 6 years. And this was not the only one that was in Brooklyn. And this particular article mentions that the latest outbreak took place within a close-knit Orthodox Jewish population in Brooklyn. There have been similar outbreaks among Orthodox Jews in the past. Some of the children had not been vaccinated, perhaps because of preference within the community to delay vaccination, health officials said. Again, so this is a very, you know, vague statement. It's not an indictment on any particular community, nor is it a charge, even here in this article, that the community is guilty, you know, withholding vaccinations, therefore this has happened. But it's noteworthy, and, you know, the doctors and the press and people are picking up on the fact that these outbreaks seem to be more common in communities which choose to withhold vaccinating their children, and of particular interest to us is that we're talking over here about an Orthodox Jewish community. Another important point, and that this comes from the U.S. National Library of Medicine. It's just an abstract for an article which talks about a mumps outbreak in the Orthodox Jewish community in the United States. This was printed in 2012. And over here, this is very interesting because it points out that from approximately June of 2009 till 2010, there were 3,500 outbreak-related cases of mumps in New York City, two upstate New York counties, and one New Jersey county. And 97% of these case patients were Orthodox Jews, adolescent males, age 13 to 17. Now, what's interesting about this is 89% of these patients had previously received two doses of mumps-containing vaccine, and 8% had received one dose. So what this study shows is that the Orthodox Jewish community may be at higher risks of outbreaks, even if there's a very high degree of vaccination. The features of this outbreak suggest, it says in the conclusion, that intense exposures, particularly among boys in schools, facilitated transmission, overcame vaccine-induced protection in these patients. And some of the articles which speak at great length talk about the way the boys in yeshiva interact with each other in close quarters, learning over one Gemara, you know, perhaps not necessarily being, boys are boys, but, not necessarily being as sensitive to hygiene issues. And what this shows is something which is very important in light of the fact that we're talking about how this affects the Orthodox community, and that is that, you know, no vaccine is foolproof. We know that already. So even a community that protects itself by vaccination may be more vulnerable. So when you couple that with the study beforehand that suggests that Orthodox Jews may not be, you know, on the up and up when it comes to vaccinating their children, and combine it with the fact that there seems to be indications that we may be more prone to outbreaks, so that, you know, could be something of particular concern to us. So let's talk about some of the sources and how this relates to us from a halachic perspective. We'll come back to this. Famous pasuk in Parshas Ki Tsetse. You have a pasuk. You have a picture over here. I believe if you open up the Chumash, you won't find any pictures. So that's what you get coming to my PowerPoint shiurim. Ki sivna bayis chadash v'asisa makel gagecha v'lo sasim damim v'vesecha ki yipol anofel mimenu. The Torah says when you build a new house, you should place a makel, which means a fence, on the roof. You shall not put something which is hazardous in your home, because we're concerned, in this case of the makkah, that someone may fall off of the roof. These are two examples of a makkah. Please note that the roofs that are illustrated over here, pictured over here, are flat roofs. So if you have a slope roof, then there's no need for a makkah because nobody's going to be on the roof anyway, hopefully. But a flat roof, which of course people would from time to time like to sit and relax and sunbathe, whatever the case is. So that's a halacha, it's a mitzvah min haTorah, mitzvah deraisa, to place a makeh. But this is sort of this mitzvah is an expanding one. It's not limited to this particular case. So for example, the Rambam this is from the Shulchan Aruch, Kosh Mishpat, Tav Chav Zayin. Interestingly, just you should know, this is the last siman in all of Shulchan Aruch. Right? In Shulchan Aruch we have four sections, Arachayim, Yerodeya, Eben Ezer, Kosh Mishpat. Chosh Mishpah is the last, and this is the last siman, the last section, the last chapter in all of Shulchan Aruch talks about the laws of Makkah. And the Shulchan Aruch writes, Echad Hagag, and this is, of course, is of a summary of the Shittos in the Gemara and the Rishonim, so we're just sort of skipping to the end to see the full picture over here. Echad Hagag, V'yachad Kol Davar Sheyesh Bo Sakana, V'roi Sheyichshol Bo Adam Yamos. Whether we're talking about a roof or anything which is potentially dangerous and hazardous to someone, and someone can get hurt, trip, and die. Let's say a person has a well or some other pit in their yard, in the field. Whether there's water in there or not, which of course would be applicable to someone who has a pool. Chayiv lasos choya gavo yudfachim, there has to be a fence, a perimeter that's constructed to at least 10 tfachim high. O lasos lo kiso, it has to be covered. Kidesh lo yipo ba'adam v'yamos, lest the person not inadvertently fall and die. The next sif says, v'chein kol michshol sheyesh bo sakanas nefashos, this is not only limited to situations where someone may fall. Any michshol, any hazard, something which could lead to death, mitzvah saseh, there's a positive mitzvah in the Torah, lahasiro, to remove it, uli shamer mimenu, and to protect yourself from it, uli zar b'davar yafeh, and to be very careful to distance yourself. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, we saw this pasuk, we discussed in earlier weeks, hishon lecho shmor nafshecha ma'od, vim lo hisir v'niach neshchol hamachsholos hamavim lidei sakana, but if you don't remove it, you leave it there, b'tel mitzvah saseh, number one, you have forfeited the opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah, and you have violated a law in the Torah, a negative instruction, a prohibition of losas and damas and yisecha, that you should not leave hazards around your house. And then the Mechaber goes on to say, harbe devarim, asru chacham ibn neshiyesh behem sakanas nefashos. There are many things that our rabbis prohibited because they believed that they were dangerous. Sasim is bar b'tzur yeredeya. Some of them you'll find in another siman of Shulchan Aruch. Va'od yesh devarim acherim, and there are other things, and these are some. This seems to be referring to some sort of public pipe, which I guess gave, you know, water, you know, people come and take water. You shouldn't put your mouth on that pipe. We wouldn't apply that today to, you know, drinking from a water fountain, which is made for that purpose, but maybe you can think of other places, other situations you may want to apply that. You shouldn't drink at night because of the concerns that maybe the waters had leeches and other, you know, creatures that have either poisoned the water, you'll unintentionally ingest them. Shem yivla aluka, v'lein aroa. Okay, good. Tells us that maybe you'll find a leech and you wouldn't see it. Chala overal dvarim elu. Anybody who violates these instructions or anything like it and says, harini mistakim v'yasmi, leave me alone. You know, I'll take the risks I want to take. U'malachim alai b'kach. It's none of your business. Or he says, eini machbik b'kach. I don't care about it. I'm not concerned. I know what I'm doing. Makinos u'makas mardis. Ironically, we beat him up. If a guy takes such an attitude towards his body, what we do is, if he refuses to comply, so we do with anybody who's a deviant when it comes to halacha, and that is that if necessary, they force him. Last words in all of Shulchan Aruch, a person who is careful about this and mindful should be blessed for his diligence. So here you have sort of a summary of all that comes, again, from that. The Torah is very precise, very discreet, very, you know, particular and limited in terms of this particular mitzvah, but we see how Chazal expand it and apply it to so many other cases. What's important to note over here is that, and we'll talk about this in a moment, but that the Shulchan Aruch mentions the fact that the rabbis sometimes forbade things. Now, you think about it for a moment. Why do you need a rabbi to forbid something which is dangerous? Right? You have common sense. You have your doctor. You read Reader's Digest, wherever you get your information, and you learn about this latest craze and this new scare. So, well, why do you need a rabbi? Right? Really, shouldn't need rabbis to tell you what's dangerous? Then again, you're all here to learn about health from me. So, yeah.
But even if you're not motivated for the health reasons, maybe you'll be motivated.
Oh, that's a good suggestion. And people who are not particularly, they don't care what the doctor has to say. You know, maybe they're very religiously minded. I think there's another point over here, and it will become more evident in a source we're going to see in a moment. I want to mention the point now, and that is, yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, a person wants to know what the halacha is, right? It's similar to what Rita said, but I think there's another point, and that is that we're not talking about things over here that are obviously dangerous. Things that are obviously dangerous, people, things that everybody knows to be truly hazardous. They don't need the rabbi to tell them that. People don't need the rabbi to tell them don't jump off of buildings without a parachute. Right? Why is that not in Shulchan Aruch? Because we're not talking about things that statistically are considered to be very dangerous. We're talking about things over here. I mean, the examples that were mentioned are not necessarily the best examples because we can't relate to them. But, you know, 500 years ago and more, these were considered to be, you know, behaviors that were common, that were considered to be hazardous, but not the kind of things that everybody knew or believed necessarily. And so therefore, sometimes the rabbi stepped in to say, listen, based on the information we have, this is considered to be risky enough behavior that we want to tell you that the halacha forbids it. But of course, there are many other things, potentially infinite number of things that people could do, which are prohibited, which are not mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, because anybody, you know, with a brain is going to know, you know, this is not the safe thing to do. What is the threshold for halakhically significant sakana? What would we say? You know, which point, let's talk percentage points. You know, how dangerous does something have to be for the rabbis to step in and say, you know, you really shouldn't do this? So what would you say? Take a guess. I'm not going to give you a conclusive number, although I've heard, you know, numbers, and I believe we generally work with certain numbers. So there's an interesting tshuva of Moshe Feinstein. He's talking over here about the prohibition that's known in the Gemara as Mayim Megulin. You may have heard about this, and that is that the Talmud says it's prohibited to drink from water and perhaps other beverages as well that have been left unattended overnight, because there's a concern that maybe a poisonous snake went ahead and took a drink and deposited some of its venom in the cup. And Ramosha is talking about the fact over here that people today are not nizhar, that people are not, mindful of this prohibition, and that would seem to be justified, that if you leave some water left over overnight, you could drink it the next morning. But he says, we don't have poisonous snakes. I mean, we have them in the world, but you certainly don't have them in your kitchen. So we drink from the water. So the Shamba Arti, I explained that Tosos, we're not going to see the Tosos right now, but Moshe says, the Hadavar Shebeminyan, Shayiba Isser Giloy, that the fact that the rabbis got up and instituted an Isser drinking from this water, the rabbis realized that this was not a common problem. This is not the kind of thing that, you know, happened, you know, half the time. So much so that if you would have asked your non-Jewish neighbor, he'd have said, come on, you're crazy. What are the chances of drinking water and actually, you know, lo and behold, your cup have to be poisoned by the snake the night before? In the world, they didn't think that this was considered dangerous. However, the rabbis thought that even though it was a very, very small and minute chance of danger, that was enough for them. And therefore, they forbade it. Therefore, Moshe says, in a case when there are no snakes around at all, you don't even have a smoke shash, there's no problem. But what I want you to appreciate is how Moshe is saying that even in the days where the rabbis instituted this halacha, so they were sensitive to the fact that this was not as considered a significant risk. There was not considerable concern over here. It was minor, but yet it was enough for them to say, you know what, you left the water out overnight, don't drink from it. It would seem, therefore, that the threshold for halachically significant sakana is very low. Now, that doesn't mean that each and every one of us can come up with all sorts of ideas that we think are dangerous and impose that on others. You know, there are people who maybe go a little far with this. Nor does it mean the rabbis today have the right or the authority to go ahead and make takanos based on, you know, what we consider to be, mildly, you know, risky or dangerous today. There are things today that we know to be dangerous. And again, like I said before, you don't need your rabbi for that. But note that in the days of the Talmud, they felt compelled to forbid us from doing certain things that were not considered to be of considerable risk. What if there was no specific rabbinic legislation at all? What if we observe something that seems to be important or dangerous for as far as our health is concerned, and the rabbis haven't said anything about it? So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Yerodea, this simon was referred to when we saw the earlier simon in the Shulchan Aruch, Kuftes Zion Hay. A person shouldn't put coins in his mouth. I don't think too many of us would put money in our mouth anyway. Probably because we're mindful of this fact. Maybe there's dried saliva of someone who had a contagious disease. I mean, that's pretty much on the mark. I think we would probably say the same thing today. Most of us would not put money in our mouth, you know, for the very same reason. Now, what are the chances of actually contracting some illness? I don't know, and frankly, I don't want to know, but we wouldn't do this. And then the Shulchan Aruch goes on to say you shouldn't do anything, other things. You shouldn't put your food in certain places. You shouldn't take a loaf of bread and stick it under your arm because, the perspiration may contaminate it. You shouldn't put foods under the bed because then you have what's called a ruach ra, which is some sort of spiritual force. But then the Rambam writes, and it says in red, V'chein yizor mikol dvarim hamavim l'day sakana. Says the Rambam, anything that could be considered dangerous, you should watch out for it. In other words, Rambam is saying, you don't need the rabbis to tell you every single example. People have to use their common sense, and they have to be informed, and get their information from, you know, reliable, informed sources. But anything which can bring a person to sakana, again, we're not saying that any chash rakuk in the world, but things that could be dangerous, you have to stay away from them. Ki sakanta chamira meyisura. And then says Rama, an expression which is found in the Talmud, that when it comes to sakana, we are actually more concerned about that than we are when it comes to an isser prohibition. V'yeshlochesh yoseh l'safik sakana milasafik isser. I believe we referred to this earlier in one of our earliest lectures, that we should be even more concerned when it comes to a doubtful sakana, a doubtful danger, than we are when it comes to a doubtful prohibition. And the Ramah goes on to give us other examples. Be careful when you walk at night or even during the day. If it looks like there's a wall that's about to collapse, don't walk next to the wall. Don't drink, again, we saw this beforehand, don't drink from the rivers at night. You don't know what you're going to be drinking. These were all examples of things that were and maybe still are considered to be hazardous. Now the very, very important question when it comes to discussing vaccines, and that is there a difference between refraining from dangerous activities and engaging in proactive behaviors? When you think about it, you know, when we choose to get immunizations for ourselves or our children, that's prophylactic. We're trying to prevent an illness from, you know, from the child contracting the illness down the line. Right now, the child, as far as we know, is completely in perfectly good health. So everything we've discussed until now, at least from the halakhic perspective, was all about what? Refraining from dangerous activities. I'm not going to go back, but if you look back at all those sources, without exception, they were all about what? Don't do this because it could lead to this danger, etc. But what about the obligation? Is there in fact an obligation to engage in proactive behaviors which would eliminate or reduce the chance that we would find ourselves in a perilous situation later? So look at this interesting halacha in the Ramah Yerodea, Kuf Tez Zayin. Actually, I believe that's a mistake. I think it's Arachayim. Actually, no, excuse me. It is Yerodea. I stick with that. The Ramah says, Old Kosfu. When there is a plague, a particular plague, an outbreak of some illness in the city, get out. Run away. You know, don't wait until, you know, it's spread completely and everybody's been infected. As soon as you hear that there's an outbreak of Dever, go. So what does that show you? If you understand that conceptually for the moment, I am not yet infected. I'm not going to go ahead and kiss my neighbor who's been infected. I'm going to stay inside my home and lock the doors. So says Ramana, that it's a halacha, according to the Maharil. Again, it's an interesting place. We don't usually think to look to the Shulchan Aruch for these types of instructions. Go. Run out. Go home. And, you know, escape the city. The Mishnah Berurah in Aruch Chaim, and that's why I got confused from her, the Mishnah Berurah in Aruch Chaim, Hilchos Tanis, was talking about when certain public fast days were declared. So it happened to be, I believe this is a reference to smallpox, kishababuos, porchim betinokos and mesim, when there's an outbreak of smallpox and children are dying, yishlig zartanis. This is a time where it would be appropriate for the tzibor to have a public fast day. V'kvar nidva slicha al tachlu yiladim. And lo leinu, there are slichos that have been composed to commemorate as a way of experiencing the very tragic demise of children who passed away in these terrible outbreaks. The Shalah writes, run away. Again, take your family and just leave the city because these are contagious diseases. They're contagious diseases. Don't just stand around and say slichos, but run. So rules the Mishnah Berurah. This is a quote from Usher Bush, who is a shul in Muncie. He teaches at Frisch. He works for the Vada of Kashrus of Riverdale. I believe he's the head of the Vada Halacha for the RCA, so very well-known individual who wrote really an incredible article on this topic, and he writes the following: given the negligible risks involved with vaccination, the question needs to be asked, is this procedure with its small risk of minor pain, swelling, and slight fever, which are the more common risks associated with immunization vaccinations, any less safe than flight from towns in times of plague, particularly when travel was far more insured and safe destinations were not to be taken for granted? This even remains true today, as the statistical odds of a fatal traffic accident are likely greater than that of vaccination fatality, and so too for accident-related injuries versus non-lethal side effects of vaccinations. So, again, it's been a while since we had a picture, so that's the best I can get for pictures of people escaping with their families from Dever, and, you know, a cute little kid getting a shot. Are they the same? And the answer is, of course not. So the Ramah tells us, again, run away. One or right, when there's a plague in the city and there were risks, there were real risks involved in just taking the kids, you know, and going who knows where to escape the plague. But it was still considered to be the better option because it was safer then. To just sit around and allow yourself to contract a contagious illness doesn't make any sense. And when you compare that to the risks that may be involved, and these are the known risks, we're not talking about autism, which we've dealt with that for the moment, but the minor pain, the swelling, and the slight fever, so, you know, it seems to be a much safer, risk than, much smaller risk than running away with one's family. So why are we still having this discussion? I should dismiss you early tonight, right? Everybody's been convinced. In fact, someone said today before the shiur that her son has to get a vaccine, but he said today, maybe I should hold off until after the shiur tonight. And she said, no, absolutely not. I want you to be, and she gave him the right answer. I want you to be vaccinated. Get your shot today. I'm going to learn, but one has nothing to do. And she's right. So why are we still having this discussion? Could there be any question whatsoever regarding the halachic requirement to vaccinate ourselves and our children? What would you say?
No.
Of course, it's 9:09. You think I'm going to let you out 20 minutes early? Of course there is. There has to be. So the answer is yes. The answer is yes. But look at the question. I'm not trying to trick anybody. Could there be any question whatsoever regarding the halachic requirement to vaccinate ourselves and our children? And the answer is yes. So why? What could be the question? So I'll tell you. This comes from, these are highlights of a statement on risk versus benefit of vaccinations by David Satcher, who is Assistant Secretary for Health and Surgeon General. This is part of testimony that he gave before the House Committee on Government Reform in August 1999. And these are just some of his statements. He points out that the polio vaccine was licensed in the U.S. in 1955. During 1951 to 1954, there were an average of 16,000 plus polio cases and 1,879 deaths from polio reported each year. As of 1991, polio caused by wild-type viruses has been eliminated from the Western Hemisphere. In other words, the polio vaccine works. A physician entering practice today may never see a case of meningitis due to Haemophilus influenzae type B. I think it's called HIB, right? Is that how it's pronounced? Good. Before the introduction of effective vaccines in 1988, approximately 1 in 200 children under the age of 5 developed invasive HIV disease. It was the leading cause of bacterial meningitis in children under 5. This was very real. It affected people. I mean, I know at least one person was affected by it. I'm sure you know others as well. By 1998, vaccination of preschool children reduced the number of HIV cases by more than 99%. In other words, the vaccine works. In the 1960s, many people witnessed firsthand the terrible effects of rubella, commonly known as German measles. During an epidemic between 1964 and 65, about 20,000 infants were born with deafness, blindness, heart disease, mental retardation, and other birth defects because the rubella virus infected the pregnant mothers. Today, thanks to the universal use of an effective vaccine, the rubella virus poses virtually no threat to the children of expectant mothers. In other words, the vaccine works. So I go back to my original question. Could you make a case that there is not a halachic requirement to vaccinate yourselves or your children? Still don't see it. Right. If we're talking about myself as an individual, the answer is yes. A case could definitely be made. And in fact, don't throw anything at me. You know, the predominant view among the postkin, and you can't walk out now until you let me finish my whole statement, is that it is very difficult to make a case that any single one individual is required to vaccinate themselves or their children, because if you live in this part of the world, because the risks right now of contracting any one of these illnesses are so low. In other words, vaccination works. So hold on one second. Ironically, therefore, the very success of vaccination has become the most compelling consideration for Poskim. Given the empirical reality that the vast majority of the school population does vaccinate, producing the phenomenon of herd immunity, the particular risk to any given unvaccinated child is relatively small. While the risk is indeed much greater than it would be for the vaccinated child, in absolute terms, it is still small. Now, I want you to take a look at a quote. I forgot exactly how my slides go. It's a little out of order, so I'm more ahead of myself than I should be. But this is a statement from the Sefer Nishmas Avram, famous work on medical and halachic issues. And he writes over there, he quotes from Rav Yeshua Neuwirth, who passed away several years ago. Rav Neuwirth, known as the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, but he spoke in Paskin and, you know, taught on other issues as well. And he wrote that despite the fact, that vaccines work, there does not seem to be a premise by which people could be forced halachically to vaccinate their children. Many poskim, including Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav Shimon Neuwirth, as it says, and many other poskim that we are familiar with in our community, feel that given the statistical unlikelihood that any one individual contract these diseases, one is not halachically compelled to vaccinate themselves or their children. However, I want you to follow this. Nevertheless, in a situation where there was either a legal obligation or a school policy regarding vaccinations, individuals would be required. These poskim maintain that while we cannot force such vaccinations, parents should be strongly encouraged to vaccinate their children, personal hesitations notwithstanding. Again, this, we're not talking about poskim that are wondering, you know, who knows, maybe Andrew Wakefield knew what he's talking about. They're not part of the conspiracy theories over here. They're just looking at the evidence of the likelihood of contracting polio, you know, rubella, you know, HIB, etc. today and saying, listen, you know, if you don't take it, chances are you're still not going to get it. Additionally, physicians are obligated to try to persuade such patient parents to vaccinate their children. Many of these postgame are distressed and somewhat incredulous that parents should act so responsibly by refusing to vaccinate their children in the face of the use of universally accepted medical practice, but appreciate the integrity of postgame who find themselves pulling their hair out that parents could be so stupid, but yet can't bring themselves to say, you are halakhically required to do this. Now, on the one hand, they're saying, well, how could a parent not? So therefore what? I'm just going to write off and say you are halakhically required? Rabbis are not authorized to go ahead and say that you're halakhically required to do something, even if they really think you should. This, of course, would change if more parents did not vaccinate. But as long as the system functions at a 90-plus compliance rate, and in this country it's thankfully, you know, way above that, the increased risk for the 10% may be halakhically insignificant. There was one Rav, not saying the only one, but very one well-known posek who disagreed with this, and that's Rav Yosef Shalom Yashiv Zecher Tzadik Livracha, considered by many to be the great posek of Klal Yisrael, until he passed away several years ago. He based his opinion on the Rambam that we've now referenced three consecutive weeks. The Rambam Hilchos Deos writes that taking care of our bodies is not just a responsibility, you know, towards our guf, but it's responsibility towards our soul. And the Rambam writes that we can't properly serve Hashem without taking care of our bodies and without making sure that we live healthy lifestyles. And so therefore, the Rambam goes on to say a person should have, you know, appropriate diets and should have healthy sleeping habits. And the Rambam goes on, we're not going to read this again right now, all of them, but the Rambam goes on to give what he believes to be, you know, appropriate medical advice, you know, his directions for a healthy lifestyle, etc. And we went through this last week, and I'm going to repeat it right now. Based on this, well, only based on half of this, this is also the Sefer Nishmas Avraham, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach points out that some of the instructions that the Rambam gives over here actually contradict that which is found in the Talmud, which raises a very interesting question, and that is that how does the Rambam, you know, living, you know, 1,000 years after the Chasimus of Talmud, who authorizes him to go ahead and to, you know, to give suggestions and instructions which really contradict, you know, traditions that we've had for centuries. So he writes, the Nishmas Avraham writes, "Shemati mi hagon Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, shevada yesh kan stira bein ma shekotzav Rambam ma shekotzav Chazal." There is a contradiction. Ach tzrichim lomar, you have to say, "Shaharamam kotzav as kol haperek lefi hayada harafui b'shev zmano." The Rambam bases on what medicine was informing him in his day. V'chein anu tzrichim hisnaig lefi hayada rafui shel zmanenu v'lo kefi shemamut haRambam kan v'asol lachos lefi rosafos haTalmud. That we have to follow when it comes to medical issues, what doctors tell us. And just like the Rambam did not hesitate to give certain instructions which contradicted that which it said in the Talmud, if doctors tell us something today which goes against that which the Rambam says, we would be required, based on the teaching of the Rambam himself, to follow their instructions and their guidelines. This now is a quote from an article called Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy by Rabbi Kiva Tass from page 48. And I want to read this to you. The question was put to Rabbi Yashiv, who ruled that the parents should accede to immunization despite their concerns. When asked if the reason behind this ruling was the issue of fairness and the obligation to share responsibility, Rabbi Yashiv indicated that it was. His reason was that since immunization of children is normal practice throughout the world, one should follow that normative course. In fact, Rabbi Yashiv went so far as to assert that failure to immunize amounts to negligence. He then continues, refusing child immunizations on the basis of substantiated fears of vaccine side effects is irresponsible and out of order halachically. the danger of precipitating epidemics of measles, polio, and other diseases with potentially devastating complications is far more real than the dangers attributed to vaccines on the basis of anecdotal claims. Until objective evidence to the contrary accrues, the halakhically correct approach is to do what is normal. In addition, a legitimate government's legislation concerning standards of medical conduct adds weight to their halakhic acceptability. So Rabbi Yashiv rules definitively that you are halakhically required to vaccinate yourselves and your children against most of his contemporaries. The most other poskim, again, and it's summarized well over here. Oh, this is just a nice PS on the bottom. I found in another source that the Rabbi Yashiv, this seems to be a quote, I don't know if it's his quote or a quote from whoever put this little notebook together on these issues. The question over here, which we haven't really touched upon directly, is what about, if, forget school policy for the moment. If you have a situation where you have 20 kids in a class and one kid's parents refuse to vaccinate him, so can the other 19 parents force the one? So Rabbi Yashiv ruled yes. Right? Normally, you know, I can't force my neighbor to do anything, even if they're violating the halacha. But over here, it's in the rights of the majority, so not only 19 to 1, I'm just using that as an example. The majority of the parents have a right to go ahead and force the minority in this case and say you must vaccinate your children or you got to get them out of school. Now, in an article that I saw online from Yitzhak Breidowitz, formerly a Rav in Silver Spring and now lives in Yerushalayim, he writes, at the end of the day, and I think it's important to point this out, the difference between Rabbi Orbach, as one example, and Rabbi Yashiv are very small. Both agree that parents should be encouraged to vaccinate the children because the benefits far outweigh the risks. Both agree that schools and parents of vaccinated children can legitimately exclude non-vaccinated children from the classroom to minimize the dangers to their own children. I didn't see that in the writings of Shlomo Zalman Aruch. To the contrary, I actually thought I saw otherwise, but I'm willing to see it for the moment. They disagree on whether vaccination is an absolute parental obligation or merely a highly desirable thing to do. So that's really the debate where we're left. From the perspective of a Jew who seeks to do the will of God, both positions will lead to this same result. So to me, I'm fascinated with the notion, and I was leading you exactly where I was being led when I was reading through the sources, coming myself to the conclusion that, of course, at the end of the day, every posuk is going to rule you must vaccinate yourselves and your children. And then initially, I was a little disappointed. What happened? Why'd you say no? But I've come to appreciate and understand, once again, that, that thankfully, and again, ironically, because of the success of vaccines and that their widespread use, again, certainly in this part of the world, so we are, for the most part, if we're not biologically immune, we are demographically immune, sociologically immune, and therefore, that creates a pretext where a case could be made that it is not halakhically required for each and every individual to vaccinate their children. An important point that's made by Rav Asher Bush, at this point the matter would seem rather simple. According to one approach, there is an obligation to vaccinate even when the statistical risks are relatively low, and according to the other approach, it's not an obligation but still remains a sensible and prudent path to follow. And this needs to be emphasized because I don't know how many people have doubts coming in here tonight, we're somewhat on the fence, and I don't know if I've made you feel one way or the other, despite, your feelings coming in. But for those of you who do end up speaking about what you learned tonight or even what you study beyond with other people, it's important to appreciate this statement. There is no thought in halakha or hashgacha to suggest that there is something less than desirable in providing the best preventative care possible. There is nothing that we presented tonight, and there's nothing out there that you're going to find which is going to suggest that it would be anything less than desirable to provide the best preventative care for yourselves and your children. Needless to say, there may be isolated cases where such vaccinations would not be in the medical best interest of the child and should not be done. Those cases obviously are indeed few and far between, and obviously that's something that you'll hear from your physician, not from your rabbi. Now, this article comes from the Jewish Daily Forward, not really my paper of choice. Maybe the only time you'll ever hear me quoting from the Forward, but it was the most accessible article on this topic, published September 2014. Hot off the press. Are ultra-Orthodox turning away from vaccination? So this is a magazine that was distributed in several major Orthodox communities, PEACH, Parents Educating and Advocating for Children's Health. And the cover story is the autism mystery, how to prevent your children from being damaged by vaccines. Now, this is an orthodox magazine. Yeah. I'm going to refrain from calling it propaganda, but it's really what it is. The autism mystery. You know, here we go again. Again, so I know that there are and there always will be conspiracy theorists out there, but, you know, I'd be lying if I said, you know, that, you know, there's not a part of me as an Orthodox Jew that's embarrassed that this information is being disseminated on this level. This is an Orthodox glossy called Peach Magazine, launched in April, this past April in English. Copies distributed in Orthodox papers in Brooklyn. We have heard what the pro-vaccine side has to say, and we are decidedly opposed to their largely unfounded claims. An introduction on the issues, second page reads. So, highlights from this very disturbing article include the following. Ultra-Orthodox Jews who declined to vaccinate the children have been at the center of a handful of outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases in recent years, including one large measles outbreak in Brooklyn in 2013, another in London the same year, and an early outbreak in Jerusalem in 2007. It's unclear how many ultra-Orthodox patients skip vaccines for the children. A representative of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene said that 96% of students in Yeshiva in Brooklyn are vaccinated. That's good to hear, although you could argue that's, you know, that's twice, you know, the national average as far as, you know, non-vaccination, because I think we saw early 1.8 nationally, and here it seems to be 4%, but okay. But clearly you can't say it's a pervasive problem among Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn, and ultra-Orthodox inside of Brooklyn say that vaccinations are nearly universal in that community. Vaccines work on the theory of herd immunity. We've seen this already. The notion that disease outbreaks can be prevented if a population has a high proportion of people who are immune to a given disease. If you have a community where the herd immunity is very, very low, and also if there's crowding of very large families, then the disease could spread rapidly. That appears to be what happened in ultra-Orthodox communities in Brooklyn in 2013, when 58 people were sickened in the largest measles outbreak since 1996. You see that? 1996. I mean, that's incredible. In over 20 years, almost 20 years, according to a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report on the incident, nearly 80% of the people fell in the Bar Park section of Brooklyn were members of three extended families whose members declined use of measles vaccine. Nine of those who got sick in Williamsburg had also refused vaccination. The ultra-Orthodox community in Hackney experienced the measles outbreak in 2013 that also spread among unvaccinated young people. This is right before the last slide of the evening, but this is very important. This is very important, and I mention this. Orthodox opposition to vaccines where it exists does not appear to be based on religious objections. It's very interesting, and not something that I would have assumed. I would have assumed that the opposition that's coming, if it's true and how great it is, I don't know, but the opposition that seems to be coming from within certain Orthodox communities, you would think is coming from people who have certain religious objections, but that doesn't seem to be the case. These are not people who are citing chapter and verses saying no. It just happens to be that, you know, you forgive me, you know, you have the herd immunity, sometimes you have a herd mentality as well. And there's an idea that's out there. A Rebbe gets up and he says something, and people listen, and they follow. But it's not necessarily based on certainly not necessarily based on scientific information, but most importantly, not based on religious objections. Now, why is this important? No, I lied. I have two more. This is my second to last slide. This is from the Department of Health and Senior Services of the State of New Jersey. All right? So this is the actual law. When a parent or guardian submits their written religious exemption to immunization, it goes back to what you said before, isn't it required? So the answer is no. When a parent or guardian submits their written religious exemption to immunization, which contains some religious reference, those persons charged with implementing administrative rules, NJC 857.44, namely to immunize the children, should not question whether the parent's professed religious statement or state of belief is reasonable, acceptable, sincere, or bona fide. In practice, if the written statement contains the word religion or religious or some reference thereto, then the statement should be accepted and the religious exemption of mandatory immunizations granted. So basically, in the state of New Jersey, you just have to submit a piece of paper that says that you are religiously opposed to, you have an actual sample here, okay? From a school nurse. Here we go. Is that what this is?
That is.
She took the name out. To whom it may concern, is the parents up? We didn't prepare beforehand, did we? Okay. A nurse in one of our yeshivos who has just handed me just this, that as parents, okay, so, and they are using the, actually, not the religion card, the most essential spirit, spiritualness and spirit. Good for them. So that brings me to my last point over here, and that is that you got to call it what it is. We've seen that there really is no basis for religious exemption over here. So, Rav Asher Bush, and this is the last slide of the evening, as is clear from the words of this code, the exemption is available for any and all professing a religious belief that vaccination is inappropriate, and such beliefs may not be questioned by any secular authorities. This language is most appropriate for the state, which neither has the interest nor the right to defend religious doctrine. Were it to do so, it would likely soon find itself embroiled in legal action. However, this is not at all relevant to yeshiva, which by definition sets the religious standards that are to be followed under its roof in all matters, both large and small. Even though the code itself does not state that this exemption is to be given without questions being asked, there is no legitimate way that an Orthodox parent of an otherwise healthy child can claim that their religion prohibits or discards vaccination. So they can say it technically, I guess they can get away with it, but if people want to speak with integrity and honesty, there's no basis for it. So you can't argue with them because the law protects them, but really there is no religious basis, there's no halachic or ashkafic basis whatsoever to prohibit or discard vaccines. On the other hand, some states allow exemptions based on personal beliefs. While there is nothing dishonest about a yeshiva parent having such a personal belief, it is a misguided one that should be corrected, and if you don't know why it should be corrected, so start again and you'll review what we did this evening. But from a religious perspective, there is none. So I ask you that when you read and you hear and you learn about rabbis who are getting up in public and they are preaching and they are teaching that vaccines are the cause of the problem, they're not the cure, and the whole thing is one big hoax and things like that, and it's upsetting and it's disturbing, and then you start to wonder and you start to second guess yourself, what is the Torah preaching, what is the Torah teaching, what chapter and verse is being cited over here, which could suggest that we should, roll time back now 100 years from now and have to deal, as you just said, with all those dreadful illnesses. And the answer is there is none. There is none. They just happen to be people of influence and people who, have an audience and they speak. And, they're not the only people in the world who have opinions and they're entitled to them. But understand that from a halachic perspective, there's really nothing to discuss. A very strong case can be made that you are required in the Torah to vaccinate your children. An even stronger case can be made that you really should, even if you're not necessarily required. No case can be made whatsoever to say that you can't or that you shouldn't, that you should be discouraged from vaccinating yourselves or your children. We should all be healthy. We should all be well. We should continue to find cures for all of our illnesses. And may we all have a healthy week. We'll return next week.